This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to the Weekly Hotwire. In this episode, we head to the lowlands of North Waikato, a place where the river widens, slows, and begins its final journey to the sea. It's here that sixth-generation farmer Stu Muir has built a life shaped by water, soil, and stewardship. Stu's family has worked the same land for generations, but his story goes well beyond the farm gate. As Deputy Crown Chair of the Waikato River Authority, he's helping to lead one of the country's most ambitious restoration projects, an 80-year journey to return health and life to the river that sustains so much of the region. In our conversation, we talk about farming and biodiversity working in harmony, the power of local land care groups, and why the next generation, from school kids to young farmers, will be key to long-term change. Stu's outlook is refreshingly honest and deeply hopeful. It's a reminder that real progress doesn't come from politics or policy alone. It comes from people who care enough to act. Stu is with me now. Hello, Stu. Thanks for joining me today.
With pleasure.
Please, can you tell me a bit about yourself, where you live, and what you get up to day to day?
Day to day, well, that varies in itself. So I'm born and bred in the northern Waikato, just before the Waikato River hits the sea, just south of Waiuku on a dairy farm. Was originally a sheep and beef, well, originally dairy, then back to sheep and beef, and now back to dairy. The Waikato River runs right through the back of the farm where it opens up into a delta region. So, well, my kids are sixth generation on this farm, but to keep that in perspective, my neighbours are about 26th generation, so we don't go into too much about that. But no, we're lucky. It's a beautiful piece, beautiful part of the country. We've got the bush, we've got the ocean, we've got the harbour, and we've got the river.
Fantastic. How many cows are you running there?
500 cows.
Okay, it's a decent herd you've got there.
Yeah, it is. Well, you've sort of got to be at a level big enough so that, one, it's that manageable, but so that you can, you know, get share milkers and help promote the next generation. And we sort of realised if we'd stayed at the level we were at, we'd be in the cow shed forever.
Yeah.
Which is not something that I wanted to do forever, obviously. So, yeah, I've been dairy farming for 30 years. Didn't actually have a background in that. I did a BA in history and spent 3 years travelling through India and Asia and Africa and, you know, just a typical Kiwi thing.
Yeah,
I was probably more into music at that stage than farming. But the time came when somebody had to come back home and take over the farm. And
yep.
Now I'm a multi-million debtor.
And what about the music? Are you still into music?
Yeah. I love my guitar. It's a good release. Not quite as fanatical as I was as a teenager in my 20s and early 30s. But no, I still use it as a way of escape.
Yeah, good one. And I gather you are involved with the Waikato River Authority. Is that right?
Yeah. I was a Crown appointee, so I'm Deputy Crown Chair on the Waikato River Authority. And about 2 years ago, yeah.
Yep.
Got appointed onto that.
Fantastic. Can you tell me a bit about the work you're involved with within the organisation and what happens there on a regular basis?
So it was a separate part of the Tainui Waikato River Treaty Settlement. So it was set up, I think, in 2011, and Kim and I were the first sort of private recipients of funding in that first round of funding. They get $6 million a year, which they distribute from very small projects, like our initial one was under $10,000, up to really, really large ones. They could be up to about a million. So from little whānau, hapū, iwi groups, to farmers, to individuals, to anyone that really wants to see the health and the well-being of the Waikato River improved. It's an 80-year project.
Okay.
Because we're very cognizant of the fact that the fertiliser that was put on 80 years ago up around Taupo and that is just working its way down to us now through the aquifers and the rest of it. So it is a very, very long intergenerational project. And by 2033, I think it is, that we will be self-funding.
Really?
We also, yeah. That was part of the deal. And so we've got a fairly good putea of investments already So we just keep growing those and partnering up. You know, we've just partnered up with Watercare and whoever, whoever is willing to be part of a positive change for the Waikato River and its people.
I'm a big believer in catchment groups in general, not just for farmers, of course, but the wider community. Are you seeing a broad range of people within the community where you are involved in the project or in the projects that you are doing?
Yes and no. So, my one personally, no, I pretty much just went out on my own. At that time, it wasn't necessarily looked upon that favourably, in the farming community. It was seen as, what the hell am I doing? That's a bit odd. But in saying that, there's a hell of a lot of smaller groups that were setting up land care projects, and I ended up getting sort of invited all around the country to talk to different groups. And also, part of being that Dairy Environmental Leaders Forum, you were meeting people from all over the country that were doing really positive things in land care groups or just as family groups. A lot of it goes unnoticed, but as time went on, people could see the benefit of what I was doing, and it sort of related to their lives and their way of life, is particularly pertaining to the river. So it made sense. You know, if you're going down to your batch and there's no possums and there's no rats and all of that sort of thing, and all of a sudden the flora and fauna are regenerating, you've got tuis and kereru and an abundance of ruru and those sorts of things coming back, people could see pretty quickly that it was having a positive effect. And then that's when people sort of really started helping me out, especially around the pest control. And then in the local area, we've got the Whakaupoko Land Care, we've got Te Awaroa Arahi. And then we've just, my cousin actually, he's just set up a really big land care group, so that'll sort of supersede the lot. But yeah, now there is a lot going on. You just sometimes have to dig a bit deeper to find out what is happening.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Junior Land Care, I think, is a pretty cool program. Can you give me
Yeah.
your thoughts on the program and what's happening in your area?
So there's two or three parts to that. So I wasn't really aware of the Junior Land Care group as such, but I was very much so aware of, in our local community, things like the rat ranges, at a local school. And one of the big things that I've always been really pushing was to get our rangatahi involved in it, because I strongly believe if you get the kids involved, and you can see the kids can understand what the problems are, and they don't necessarily have that sort of those preconceived ideas or prejudices that perhaps our parents and grandparents had. So if you can change them and get them involved at a grassroots level, that's where you get, to me, real fundamental change, long-term change. And we've got to have an intergenerational viewpoint to all of these things if we are going to actually succeed in the long term. So just looking at their projects and the things that they've been involved in, it's just so heartening. It's fantastic. And the more that we can support and fund those sorts of groups. So when I was on the Endangered Species Foundation, we worked with Graham Atkins up the East Coast in Ngāti Porou on the Ngutukaka, the Kakapik project. That was all about getting it back in the kuras, back in the schools, back around the marae, and involving it at a very grassroots level. We knew the power of having that community buy-in from an early young age. Same with Trees for Survival. They do fantastic work in the schools, so I've been quite involved with them. Even the prison service, they do Waikerea Prison, do a lot of propagation on that, and I've actually wanting them, some of as they leave the prison, to actually come down and see the benefits of what their work is, because that's how you change people. If people can see a positive outcome from their actions, they're more inclined to stay on that path.
Yeah, indeed. So I guess long term, what outcomes do you see happening or hope to see as a result of programs like the Junior Landcare program?
Well, I mean, you see, somewhat immediate things in terms of planting and the regeneration of that biodiversity. But alongside that, if it, so long as there's trapping and pest control going along that, then you see the wider biodiversity. So you get the kereru, as I said before, and the tui. And when you get those sort of tangible improvements, that I think really resonates with people. But if you do just do the planting and walk away and don't do pest control, you're really not achieving those biodiversity corridors that we need, because once you get that basic biodiversity there, the birds and the insects and that, they'll come and they'll spread the seeds and so on and so forth, and continue to do your job, but on a wider landscape scale.
You touched on your children being part of the farm now, certainly growing up on the land. How are they approaching life on the land now compared to, say, you did or your parents? Are they much, I assume they're much more aware of the importance of increased biodiversity. They'll be much more aware of the benefits of clean water. How's their approach different to yours, or say your parents?
Fortunate, because my father was actually really into replanting trees and that
Okay.
sort of thing, you know, being keen on white baiting and duck shooting and all of that. And because we've been here a long time, you know, there's a lot of kōrero that's been passed down from the several generations on Māori and Pākehā side. So we were always brought up to be quite well aware of how degraded things had become. I think with the kids, though, it's on a much larger scale. You know, we used to plant 200 or 300 trees a year, and, you know, then it became thousands and thousands. And because they're attached, you know, they love to surf, they love to hunt, they fish, and, you know, they like the bush. They also love the urban environment too. But they knew and they can see what difference it has had over their short lifetime. And I think they can see the bigger picture. I mean, one's just done an environmental science degree, and she's working for Water Care. The other one's actually guiding in the Able Tasman, and oversee, you know. So they, even though they enjoyed living in Wellington and that, they always sort of get drawn back to the tile, to the environment.
So how does the likes of Landcare and Waikato River Authority and indeed farming work together? And I'm thinking long term.
Well, it's incredibly important to work together. If we don't get buy-in from all sides, and we don't always have to agree with the reasons or the why of what we're doing, the main important is that the job importance is that the job gets done. And that collaborative approach in the Waikato River Authority particularly, and most Landcare groups really, they embody that, and you get strength, and you get that intergenerational. I know I keep going on about that, but to me, it's fundamentally important. If you're going to get that change, you have to have buy-in from all walks of life. And, you know, in the past, some sectors of the farming community, very vocal sectors, have seemed quite anti it. But on the reality, when you actually go around people's farms and especially around the country, not particularly necessarily in this district, you see a lot of pride in what people do. They generally do want the best. There has been willful ignorance in the past, or no, perhaps genuine ignorance. It's the willful ignorance that I call at the moment that's hard to handle, and they are the outliers. And the best way of changing them is to have everyone else change around them, and then they sort of become isolated. You can spend a lot of energy on trying to change somebody that doesn't want to change, and you're better to go and pick the ones that really do want to make that change, and then just get in behind them and do everything that you can. And listen, that's another big thing. You know, people on the land actually know a lot about their land and what works and what doesn't. And often when you get a government organisation or a so-called expert, they don't always know the best for your area. And I think especially when you're dealing with mana whenua, in the past, though, their knowledge, and let's face it, you know, there's almost 1,000 years of knowledge there has been overlooked. But when you sit down and you have those meaningful conversations, and you understand that, okay, we might be coming from different parts of a knowledge base, but we want the same thing. So, you know, there's no not 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 a weakness in being different. Is you actually gain strength because you learn from each other. That's my view anyway.
And yeah, look, don't start me on Wellington trying to direct things in certain areas. And I guess just on the intergenerational thing, I'm a firm believer in that too. That intergenerational component is absolutely critical. One thing that I struggle with a bit is changing governments and policy changes. And wouldn't it be nice to have a bipartisan approach for a lot of these things? So farmers and communities, especially rural communities, can plan for 50 or 100 years without having to change tact or change their approach to things every time we have a new government come in.
Yeah, you know, so frustrating to so many people. I think maybe more particularly for an older generation, they don't always know where they stand, and they get kind of overwhelmed by A lot of it's about the bureaucracy, and that it doesn't have to be as hard as it is. And yeah, if we could get, I mean, it's our system, isn't it? We swing from one extreme to the other. I think the main thing is that the majority of us in the middle will just keep going no matter what. You can have everyone come out with their little sound bites and waving their flag and jumping up and down, but I think the movement's too far along to stop. I think some of our farming organisations don't actually do us a lot of justice at times, because for whatever reason, whether it be that they've got dwindling support and they need to come out with strong rhetoric, on one way or the other, and you've just seen it in the last few days, and it's like, really, the rest of the world is moving on, and we have to, as farmers, think about who actually buys our products. They're the ones that determine at the end of the day what they buy, and it's going to be produced. And our major customers, obviously, they've got very stringent standards on what it is. So if we want to be at the top of the game and not let Europe and America and the rest of them catch up and overtake us, we have to be ahead of the game,
So, what are some of the challenges that the likes of Landcare and indeed the Waikato River Authority face moving forward?
Come on, one, and it right down to the base level is funding. Where you're going to get that, where government and local bodies are abrogating their responsibilities in terms of pest control, like Osprey, it used to be a really big thing, TB free, but now they've just pulled that funding, and the council don't want to have to do it. We don't necessarily want to be seen as the only people that are going to do it. So there's and then DOC is constantly restrained as well. So I think funding is a huge thing. Obviously, legislative changes doesn't help when you see it swing from one way to the other. That's why I always think it's really important that we have a consumer-focused viewpoint in what we do, rather than a reactionary political beat up every 3 years about what's been done and what's not being done. What else? And I mean, the biggest one is the environment itself. I mean that's huge, because what's coming to us and the next generation, it's really scary. We've been doing eDNA samples of what was here the last 2-3 thousand years to see what would happen the last time this Waikato River Delta was inundated by the ocean. That could be a reality in the next 50 years. So there's massive challenges.
I'm a big believer in letting science do the talking and, decisions being made around what the evidence tells us. What do you think of that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you're not willing to follow the science, really, what are you? And when I say science, it's mātauranga Māori and mātauranga Pākehā too. It's both of us. We both have a scientific methodology based on observation and experience. And they just come from slightly different cultural viewpoints, but it's incredibly important. It's I have very little time for people that won't listen to the scientific evidence. It's you're burying your head in the sand.
And you've touched a bit on this. What have you done on your farm to improve water quality? And you've talked a bit about your children seeing changes. Have you got some measurables around that?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So one of the big, because we're on a swamp, we're the only hill on a swamp. So everyone that pretty much gets the cattle off over winter, but that was becoming exorbitantly expensive, and with the size of the herd, we had really hard to get land that close to Auckland big enough. So we ended up putting in a big wintering pad, and that totally revolutionised the way that we farmed. All that nutrient gets saved that we used to then we use in summer to put on for the crops. You're not damaging the pasture. You're not damaging the land, and it combined that we've planted tens of thousands of trees. We've opened up major waterways, the major waka route between the Manukau Harbour and the Waikato River, and opened up all these spawning ponds for whitebait. Just massive. Anything that was marginal, we put back into native bush. And if it was productive, we went hard out. Like, I've contoured literally every paddock on the farm. Has been reshaped, recontoured, and regrained, and all of that sort of thing. So it's not like I've gone down one extreme way and let the farming now of maximize or try to maximize, making a very profitable business, but at the same time, with a long-term goal of environmental kaitiakitanga or stewardship,
Farming is very important to this country, and equally good environmental stewardship is too. I guess we've touched a bit on this, but do you think we're heading in the right direction for both of these things to work in harmony?
I think some people assume that being beneficial to the environment and farming are diametrically opposed. Well, they're not. When you concentrate on your most productive parts of your farm, you actually, you get a lot more profit out of that rather than trying to break in that last 5 or 10% of land. It's never going to be much good for anything. So, like all of our hillsides, it's better off to be back in bush than trying to graze a steep hillside that doesn't grow good dairy food. It's all right for sheep and beef, and so that was my view. And parts of the swamp where you're never going to drain it properly, it was always going to be horrible and wet. Well, build a nice pond and plant some trees and make it aesthetically pleasing. And with that soil that you built the pond, then you've created those big buns, and you've got land that cattle can actually, graze and remain dry and not damage it, It's not that hard to figure out.
Stu, I've really enjoyed chatting with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Ngā mihi, my pleasure.
That was Stu Muir, a farmer, historian, musician, and environmental leader helping to write a new chapter for the Waikato River. His work reminds us that production and protection don't have to be at odds, that by focusing on what's truly productive and restoring what's fragile, we can build farms, communities, and ecosystems that endure. If you'd like to learn more about the Waikato River Authority and the work they are supporting across the region, you can visit waikatoriver.org.nz. Thank you for listening. This is the Weekly Hotwire, where we bring you stories of people shaping the future of New Zealand's rural economy, one conversation at a time.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.